speak in error. Dr. Oakley said, frowning, But something was done to you, Marianne. You've been hurt? There was the evidence she discovered, Marianne said slowly, of certain injuries on her body. She had struggled with him, the boy, whose name she did not wish to say, but he'd ripped her dress and might have struck her, unless she'd fallen, slipped and fell in her high heels on icy pavement, trying to run from his car. It had been very cold and windy, and she didn't know where her coat was, and she'd been sick. She had never been drunk before, but believed that that was what had happened to her. She'd been drinking something made of orange juice, and she'd been warned but had not listened, or could not remember having listened, and could not remember who'd warned her. She did not wish to name any names and to involve her friends or anyone, for no one was to blame except possibly herself. She might have been running and stumbling from the boy's car because she was going to be sick, ashamed to be sick, vomiting in his car. She'd believed they were parked in the Laporte's driveway because the boy had said he would drive her there, but apparently they were somewhere else, and she could not say where. Afterward, he had driven her to the Laporte's. Yet she could not speak in absolute certainty about any of this. Whether in fact the boy had said he would drive her to Trisha's house, or whether she had misunderstood. For the past few days she had been praying and meditating upon what to do, and she had decided she must do nothing, for it was she who had made the mistake and not the boy, and she must not bear witness against him. And Marianne began to cry again, helplessly, and Corinne hugged her, herself in tears, as Dr. Oakley looked on, and Corinne wept as if her heart had broken. And Marianne sat stiff, yet unresisting, allowing her mother to embrace her, but not returning the embrace until, after a short while, Marianne said calmly, looking now at Dr. Oakley, I'm ready to be examined now, Dr. Oakley, I guess. Dr. Oakley's nurse escorted Marianne into an examining room, and Corinne would have accompanied them, but Dr. Oakley suggested it might be better if she waited here. And Corinne waited. And after what seemed like a very long time, Dr. Oakley reappeared, and his expression was grim, sympathetic. It appears that your daughter has been sexually abused. Corinne was on her feet, anguished. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. She's been raped. Dr. Oakley paused, licked his lips. His thick bifocals, which left such deep indentations on the bridge of his nose, reflected an opaque light. He held a sheet of paper in his tremulous hands and frowned at it, as if his own handwriting perplexed him. There is evidence of forcible penile penetration, yes. The hymen has been ruptured, and there are bruises and lacerations in the vaginal and pelvic area, and bruises elsewhere. Thighs, abdomen, breasts. It's been several days since the assault, and so there wouldn't be, I'm sure. And here Dr. Oakley, the most gentlemanly of elder men, faltered. Any traces of semen remaining. But I've taken a smear, and we'll see.
Raped? Marianne?
Corinne, she doesn't say that. She hasn't said that, dear, you see.
But of course that's what it is, Dr. Oakley. Rape!
Dr. Oakley was shaking his head, visibly nervous, frowning at the report in his fingers. He was a man whose courtly, warmly gracious manner could sometimes shade into awkwardness. He was an old-style general practitioner of an era that preceded what he perceived as trendy psychologies, therapies. He said carefully, I've prescribed painkillers for your daughter and something to help her sleep. She's a brave young woman, and it may be that you and Michael need to listen to her and not... Again he paused with a fastidious licking of his lips. Do anything rash. These things Corinne reported to Michael in as calm and measured a voice as she could manage. She dreaded his rage, his terrible temper that erupted rarely, yet with alarming force. The bastard! I'll kill the bastard! She'd anticipated his words for hours. Tell me who it is! I'll kill him! Yet, initially, what frightened Corinne more? Michael took the news as one might take news of one's imminent mortality. He did not interrupt. He did not speak at all. He was having difficulty breathing and grasped at both her hands, his face suddenly ashen, eyes an old man's eyes, watery and incredulous. He seemed to have lost his balance, stooped and swayed, sat heavily on an upended wooden box. One of his gloves had fallen from his overcoat pocket, and his jaunty, fox-colored fedora lay on the floorboards at his feet. Quickly, pleading, thinking he might be having a heart attack or a stroke, Corinne said, "Michael, darling, it's all right. She's all right. Marianne's very brave, and Dr. Oakley says she needs to rest. She wasn't hurt badly, really. I mean...
Crouched in Michael's arms, the clumsy embrace of his arms in the sleeves of the camel's hair coat, pressing her anguished face against his. They looked up to see Patrick, bareheaded and shivering in the doorway, staring at them. His voice quivered with boyish reproach and alarm.
"Dad? Mom? What's wrong? Why are you two out here?"
"But Mort Lunt is a friend of mine."
Amid a rush of emotion almost too powerful to be borne, that was the first thought that came to Michael Mulvaney Sr. Reckless and desperate, he drove that night, giving no warning to the Lunts, into Mount Ephraim, at high speeds along the icy roads, to the Lunt home, arrived at about 9:30 in a light snowfall to find a Chautauqua County Sheriff's vehicle parked in the driveway. And there was Eddie Harris, one of the deputies, an old friend of Michael's, waiting for him. Michael bounded out of the Ford pickup without shutting the door behind him, coatless, bareheaded, and Eddie Harris quickly climbed out of the cruiser to meet him. Eddie was embarrassed, hesitant.
"Michael, hey, how's it going? What the hell are you doing here?"
"Corinne called me. She told me you might be headed here. You got a problem, huh?"
Michael saw someone at the Lunt's front door, a tall figure, Mort Lunt. He said, excited, "Not me. It's those bastards in there who've got a problem." Pushing past Eddie, who tried to block his path, "I'm going to have a little talk with them." Eddie said, taking hold of Michael's arm,
"Just a minute, Michael."
And Michael shrugged him off, furious. "Who the hell's side are you on?" The door opened, and Mort Lunt called out shakily,
I'm not afraid to speak with him, officer. We can clear this up right now."
Michael Mulvaney Sr. bounded up the steps, ignored Mort Lunt's extended hand. How strange for the two men, accustomed to handshakes, warm and even effusive greetings, to be sizing each other up now. Michael Mulvaney was an inch or so shorter than Mort Lunt, but some 30 pounds heavier, and in every way more physical, more intense. Adrenaline, thrumming through his veins, gave him a heated energy, a clammy white radiance to his face. The men were approximately the same age, approaching 50, but Mort Lunt, with his thinning, filmy gray hair and bifocal glasses, appeared older, more tentative. He shrank back from Michael as if he feared a blow to the face. Michael cried,
"Right! Right now! And where's your son? He's the one I've come to see."
Mort Lunt said, stammering, "Zachary isn't here right now."
"The hell he isn't! We'll see about that."
For some 5 or 10 minutes, the men stood talking disjointedly together in the Lunt's foyer. The sheriff's deputy remained close by, not involved in the conversation, but listening. Mort Lunt, by training an investment banker, by temperament a man given to excessive courtesy, tried to speak rationally, calmly, though his voice cracked. Michael spoke loudly and not always coherently, as if, as it would be said of him afterward, he'd been drinking. Mort acknowledged that, yes, he'd heard some disagreeable things about a party after the prom the previous weekend. He'd heard there'd been underage drinking and some pretty wild behavior, and he'd questioned his son and disciplined him. Zach was grounded for 6 weeks, denied the use of his car, an 8 p.m. curfew. Michael interrupted,
"Your goddamn son, he hurt my daughter, my little girl, last Saturday night. Hurt her. Abused her. Do you know about it, Mort? Did the little bastard tell you that?"
Mort protested, "Please, don't call my son such..."
Michael cupped his hands to his mouth and shouted into the interior of the house,
"Are you listening, you little bastard? Fucker! Get your ass down here, or I'll come get it!"
"Just a minute, Michael. Michael, wait."
Both Mort and Eddie tried to restrain Michael, and he threw them off, staggering, furious. He said to his friend Eddie,
"You call yourself a man of the law? You should be arresting this kid for abuse, assault!"
Shortly after this exchange, Zachary Lunt appeared on the stairs. He wore bleached jeans, a Grateful Dead sweatshirt. His long, lank hair fell forward into his eyes. If he'd meant to confront Michael Mulvaney defiantly, or even bravely, resolutely, all strength drained from him as Michael bounded to the stairs, grabbed him by the arm, and began to shake him.
"Bastard! Punk! What did you do to my daughter? I'll kill you!"
Mort Lunt and Eddie Harris intervened. Michael shoved at both men, striking Mort on the side of the face and sending his glasses flying.
In the struggle, Zachary Lunt slipped, fell, would have fallen onto Michael, except Michael seized him in a bear hug, cracking several ribs, and flung him against a wall where his nose was broken, bloodied. It had all happened so swiftly. In another part of the house, Mrs. Lunt was frantically dialing the Mountie from police.
They said, "Tell us." She said, "Only what I know." They said, "Tell us, so that justice can be executed." She said, "I was drinking. I was to blame. I don't remember. How can I give testimony against him?" How many times Marianne Mulvaney was to repeat these words? To her parents, to anyone who questioned her, including two Mounties from police officers when, the morning following Michael Mulvaney's disruptive and disorderly behavior at the Luntz house, they came to High Point Farm to question her in her parents' presence.
"I was drinking. It's so hard to remember. I can't swear. I can't be certain. I can't bear false witness."
Her many hours in solitude in St. Anne's Church had given her a strange, stubborn placidity new to Marianne Mulvaney. She'd been reading the Gospels. She'd been praying. Opening her heart to Jesus as she'd never done before. Oh, never. He had instructed her in the way of contemplation, of resisting the impulse to rage, to accuse. And, in truth, drunk as she'd been, sick, staggering, confused, and frightened as she'd been, she could not clearly remember what had happened between her and Zachary Lunt. So Marianne told the Mountie from police officers, her parents looking on, subdued, silent. Michael Mulvaney had been arrested the previous night. Charges of assault were pending. Yet, what could be proven against Zachary Lunt with no witness except Marianne? Her words against his. Zachary's friends would rally around him, she knew. She was not bitter, but she knew. It was clear to her, logical as a chess game in which you see your opponent's devastating moves to come, but are helpless to prevent them. Quietly, calmly repeating, "I was drinking. There's so much I can't account for. I can't remember. How can I bring criminal charges against him? I am as much to blame as can't bear false witness." As if this litany were the most basic, the most irreducible of knowable facts. Given to understand, too, that if she declined to bring charges of sexual assault against Zachary Lunt, Zachary Lunt and his father Morton would not bring charges of assault against her father. So it was, and had to be. She didn't return to school until the first Monday in March. By that time, she'd thought long and hard, much of the time in solitude in her room, and healed herself. Of course, she kept up with her school assignments. She was diligent, even obsessive about that. It was Corinne who called Marianne's teachers virtually every day. She did most of her household chores, eager to follow Mom's work schedule, which was the very essence of family life at High Point Farm. Schoolwork, chores, as if nothing was wrong. For, after all, now she was recovered. Even the nastiest of the bruises fading, nothing was wrong. "Bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use you." The Lunts did not file charges against Michael Mulvaney Sr. Marianne Mulvaney did not file charges against Zachary Lunt. These facts were distant, impersonal as radio voices fading in and out of coherence. The kingdom of God is within. Her bare knees on the floorboards of her room, her hands grasped tight, tight together, and her eyes shut, streaking tears. "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus." It was a secret thing from the first. After what he'd done to her, inside her, deep and up inside her, using his fingers, snatching, digging, clawing, "You bitch, cunt! Don't tell me you don't want it, cunt!" Pushing her down onto the back seat of the Corvette, the new-smelling leather upholstery, the cold fabric, and his furious, pale face leaning close, shoving her legs apart, her thighs, the dress ripping, and she, too weak, too terrified to resist, even to utter no. And after, brought to the Laportes, slipping in quietly in stealth and shame and guilt, and in the sparkling hot water, scrubbing herself, sobbing, and murmuring to herself, and even laughing, giggling, biting her lip to keep from making too much noise, waking Tricia and her parents. A secret and a revelation. "Blessed be they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Jesus, I thank you, I am alive. I thank you for this life, this breath. For Zachary might have strangled her after all. He might have dragged her limp body out of the car, pounded her head against the icy pavement. Hadn't that been a possibility? An unspoken, unless it was a spoken, threat? She harbored such secrets, such revelations. Dared not speak of them to her father, so upset, distraught, he was making himself sick, but spoke elliptically of them to her mother. There was comfort to be taken in such hurt. Jesus knew, on the cross. Public shame and humiliation. Knowing, of course, how everyone must be speaking of her, pitying her, at the high school and in town, through the Chautauqua Valley, Zachary Lunt would have told his buddies, of course, would have boasted. Yet even if he had not, news of it, of Marianne Mulvaney and her father's intervention, the arrest, the police, would have spread, irrevocable. You Mulvaney, think you're hot shit, don't you? Few of Marianne's friends had called to ask after her. Though she'd been absent from school for days, no boy had called. Tricia, who was her closest friend since fifth grade, hadn't called. Well, yes, Tricia had called. On Tuesday of the second week, Marianne had stayed out of school, and Corinne had answered the phone, but when Marianne called back, hours later, Tricia wasn't in. And Mrs. Laporte spoke so stiffly to her, so oddly, as if she scarcely knew who Marianne was. Marianne said quietly, "Please tell Tricia I'm sorry she's involved in any way in this." After a startled pause, Mrs. Laporte said, "Involved? My daughter? My daughter isn't involved in anything. I haven't the slightest idea what you're talking about." So she prayed, and by degrees healed herself. The bruises and abrasions were gone, or almost gone. A second visit to Dr. Oakley, and there remained only coin-sized discolorations on the insides of her thighs, where Zachary had torn at her with his furious fingers, where he'd poked, pushed his blood-engorged penis again, 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 was healed. At any rate, the bleeding had stopped. She would not know for another several weeks if her regular menstrual pattern would resume, but she wasn't thinking of that now. "I was drinking. I was to blame. If I could relive that night, but I can't. How can I bear false witness against him?" One day, Mom removed the soiled, torn prom dress from the back of Marianne's closet where it was hidden. She hadn't needed to ask Marianne where the dress was. Found it, unerring, without wishing to examine it. Wadded it into a ball and stuffed it in a paper bag with other household trash. Mom's eyes gleaming with tears, but she wasn't crying, nor was Marianne. Not a word uttered. Bright, glaring, snow-drifted winter mornings at High Point Farm. It would be Marianne's last winter here, she seemed to know. 2 mornings in succession, the last week of February, the school bus couldn't get through, so Patrick and Judd stayed home. That air of excited childish expectation, listening to WYEW-FM radio as they'd done for years, years, years on blizzard mornings, waiting to hear of county school cancellations. Though Marianne was upstairs when the Mountie from District was announced and PJ and Ranger cheered in unison. Not that PJ much liked to stay home, quarantined, as he called it, amid so much snow, silence. Winter silence. His eyes avoiding hers, young face ravaged in shock, pity, distaste. How much did Patrick and Judd know? Presumably their parents had told them something. And Mike, an adult, knew. He'd known from the first, the evening of the day Corinne had taken Marianne to Dr. Oakley. Marianne had agreed to see Dr. Oakley another time, at Mom's urging. On the examination table, steeled herself against pain, shutting her eyes. Jesus, 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 as beads of sweat formed at her hairline. But there was no pain. Jesus had helped her banish pain. Afterward, dressing herself, articles of clothing slipping from her fingers, numbed and without sensation, like strangers' fingers, weirdly annexed to her hands. She'd overheard a man's voice in the room next door. "Made the right decision under the circumstances. An ugly, messy prospect." But she'd stopped listening. There was Michael Mulvaney Sr., Dad. Tried not to think about Dad. After that first night when he'd gripped her hand so hard and cried. The shock of seeing Dad cry. She was terrified. Her heart was breaking. So she vowed not to think of it afterward, with Jesus' help. for there was nothing to be done. She could not testify against Zachary Lunt, for she could not recall with any degree of accuracy the sequence of events of the early hours of Sunday, February 14th, nor even herself during that time. It was like a movie where something has gone wrong with a film. Images continue to flutter past, but dim, confused, out of focus. Nor could she accompany her father as he wished. Where? To the Chautauqua County District Attorney's Office in Chautauqua Falls? Simply, she refused. Could not. Could not. God forgive her, she could not. And so it became a household of silence, as if in the aftermath of a violent detonation. No wonder Mom played the radio so loudly in the kitchen. Her brothers turned the TV up. Even the dogs barked at the slightest provocation. There was the discovery she'd never actually looked at, never seen Michael John Mulvaney Sr. until this time. For always he'd been Dad, or Captain, or Curly, though not Curly for years, one of the names he'd outgrown. Seeing him now, Dad, yet Michael John Mulvaney Sr., when she could not look at him directly at all, for his eyes shifted uneasily in his sockets when she appeared. If she entered a room in which he stood or sat, he would shortly leave, forehead creased, eyes shifting so he need not see her. He'd aged a decade in 10 days, heavy-footed on the stairs, turn a corner and there he was. Who? A bearish man, shoulders slumped, rubbing a fist into an eye and panting like a winded horse trying to catch its breath. His face like uncooked, flaccid dough. Daddy, I'm so sorry. Daddy, what can I say? Can't remember, can't testify. Daddy, I'm so ashamed. She did not wish to hear, but sometimes, by chance, in the bathroom adjacent to their bedroom, she heard. And there was Dad's voice lifting in anger, incredulity, and Mom's voice quieter, pleading. The quarrel subsided. You would think it had been extinguished, but like a smoldering swamp fire, it had simply gone underground and would soon erupt again another night. There were few calls these days for Corinne Mulvaney, as for her daughter. What had happened so swiftly to their popularity? She could count her friends on the thumbs of both hands, Mom joked, though Mom didn't joke much these days. Some mornings you'd hardly guess Corinne Mulvaney was in the house. They'd asked her about Austin Weidman how many times, and how ashamed she was about Austin, and about Zachary Lunt. Can't bear false witness, because I can't remember if I could relive, but I can't. Playing upon her vanity, her pride, so shrewdly, that she alone, Marianne Mulvaney, younger than he, in all ways less experienced than he, had had the power, nonetheless, to bring him, a sinner, Zachary Lunt, Zachary of the lank, dark hair and dreamy, heavy-lidded eyes, to Jesus Christ, their Savior. Like there's a real me, Marianne, being with you brings out? Not the mean, dumb asshole I usually am. Hunched like a broken-backed snake on a step beneath her at Bobby Krause's party, his thin, handsome face, sallow skin, and intense eyes, unnerving to see boys in tuxes like adult men, and Zachary Lunt most of all. But then he was 2 years older than Marianne. His bow tie removed and stuffed carelessly in a pocket, stiff white collar unbuttoned. Drinking beer, straight vodka, Zachary Lunt, even the senior girls watched sidelong but were wary of his reputation. Tales you'd hear of Zach and his buddies, a wild circle. Well-to-do kids and most going on to college, though their grades were low average and their school activities virtually nil. That gang of 5 or 6 guys hadn't exactly been invited to Bobby Krause's after the prom, but sure, Bobby was flattered, sort of, when they showed up. Zach in his new model Corvette, but lacking his prom date, poor Cynthia Slauson, he'd taken her home early, and Ike Rodman in his dad's caddy with some of the guys. They'd been drinking already and ready to party. And right away, Zach moved on to Marianne Mulvaney, staring at her in that way she'd noticed him. Impossible not to notice him staring at her, unsmiling, at basketball games and pep rallies where Button Mulvaney and her sister cheerleaders performed. And shortly afterward, they were observed in earnest conversation in the Krause's rear hall, then seated on the stairs that led to the second floor, Marianne in her beautiful, creamy satin dress with a strawberry-colored netting seated on the third step, Zack on the second, leaning on his elbow, peering up at her, as if seeing in her a way of salvation. Salvation. Oh, how could she confess to her mother, to any of them, such shame? Yet she'd believed him sincere. How otherwise? Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, scared as hell, Marianne. Why are we here on Earth if we're just gonna die? Urging her to drink the orange juice cocktail he'd made for her. So delicious. Screwdriver, somebody called it. She'd never tasted anything quite like it. Better than champagne. Sweeter than champagne she'd had several times. Far sweeter than any of Dad's and Mom's beers she'd sipped out of curiosity. And her throat was parched from the hours of dancing. She was so dizzy, so happy. But wait, was this at Bobby Krause's, or was it possibly at Glenn Paxton's? Had they gotten to Glenn Paxton's at all? She would not recall afterward. Austin Weidman was whining he had to leave by 12:30 a.m. to take Marianne to the Laportes so that he could get home by 1 a.m., which was his curfew. They laughed at him, a 1 a.m. curfew for a senior boy, and kept hovering in the rec room doorway, his bow tie crooked, his dirt-colored hair stringy where it had been fine and feathery at the outset of the long evening, and his eyes, behind thumb-smudged lenses, aggrieved. Zachary said politely he'd drive Marianne to the Laportes, where she was spending the night with Tricia, who'd already left the party, and Marianne stammered, blushing, not knowing what to say, and there was the sick look in Austin Weidman's face, as if he'd been kicked in the belly, as it began to sink in at last how he wasn't wanted. Chewed-looking lips, black plastic glasses like his father's. If you looked at him head-on, you saw he was a nice-looking boy, but who wished to look at Austin Weidman head-on? He had dabbed a sort of flesh-colored ointment over a pimple on his chin, and sweating had made it run. His breath, too, had a medicinal odor, like tooth fillings. He believed himself in love with Marianne Mulvaney, though he hadn't dared tell her or anyone. At the prom, Austin had danced awkwardly with Marianne, perspiring, staring at her in wonderment, and holding her loosely, as if he feared stepping on her delicate size 6 satin pumps with his size 12 black leather dress floor chimes. But he'd stepped on them anyway. Marianne had spent much of the time talking and laughing with her own circle of friends, as Austin looked on smiling like an elder brother. And of course she danced with other boys all evening. Lots of other boys.
"Marianne, I need your help. You're the only person who can help me."
Touching her knee, his warm fingers on the smooth satin skirt lightly, as if merely in emphasis as he spoke with such urgency. And a sudden sensation swelled like a balloon between her legs. Will he kiss me? Is that what will happen next? But he did not kiss her. Perhaps seeing something in her face, her startled eyes, that dissuaded him, he leaned close to her, his elbow now on the step beside her, looking up at her, speaking quietly, earnestly, and she'd sat transfixed, staring at him, not daring to speak nor even to breathe.
The only person... only person who can help me.
Immediately afterward, or was it much later, Marianne was laughing so hard, tears leaked unbecomingly from her eyes. Rock music, Mick Jagger's brawling voice, was deafening, so loud you couldn't hear it. Beat, 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 burrowing into the heart like heartworm. They were in the Krause's rec room, where in summer glass doors slid open onto a flagstone terrace and a pool overlooking the country club golf course. Marianne had come swimming here a few times, though she wasn't a close friend of Bobby Krause, one of the glamorous senior cheerleaders. It was time to leave. Time for the next party. Where? Zach's friends, who were all seniors Marianne didn't know, were laughing, saying Pisspot Weidman had gone home in his old man's Pisspot Dodge, which was a car that for some reason elicited derision. Marianne's friends were gone. Zach was red-faced, losing his poise, muttering in an undertone, "Fuck off, assholes," when his drunken buddies tried to detain him and Marianne at the door, tugging at Marianne's arm, even her hair, and at Zack, who shoved them away, laughing and angry.
"Hey, can we come along? Hey, Zack, ain't gonna forget your buddies, are ya?"
bawling like hyenas. The first stab of nausea hit her.
Oh, oh God.
As Zack, cursing under his breath, carried Marianne's coat, helped her walk to his car, her knees weakened suddenly so he had practically to support her, helped her climb into the freezing car, not seeing or not caring how her skirt was caught in the door when he slammed it shut. Marianne swallowed down bile, gagged, choked. Where was her little beaded purse with tissue in it? Something hot and stinging spilled from the corner of her mouth as Zack gunned the Corvette motor, jerked away, sliding from the curb. Marianne's head rolled on her shoulders like crockery. After that, Marianne didn't remember.
You Mulvaneys think you're hot shit, don't you?
No, she didn't remember. Always you maintain your dignity. Monday she'd be returning to school, she was determined. It was still February that morning, barefoot, in her flannel nightgown. Marianne descended the stairs quietly, making her way through the slumbering house drawn by the bitter cold, thin whistling wind. All night dreams had cascaded at her like snow avalanches in the mountains. She wasn't taking the chunky beige pills Dr. Oakley had prescribed to aid sleep, nor was she taking the sleek green and black capsules Dr. Oakley had prescribed to help restore appetite. But that was Marianne's secret. One of her secrets. At the rear of the house, she looked out to sea. Yes, the space where Dad's pickup was usually parked, in front of the garage, was empty. A light burned there Mom had left on all night. He hadn't come home. Of course, there were reasons why Michael Mulvaney Sr. sometimes stayed overnight in Mount Ephraim. Usually at the Odd Fellows Lodge, where there were two or three rooms available for members. Treacherous driving conditions. Hadn't it been snowing hard the night before? It was snowing now, in snaky coils and tatters blown against the windows, drifting up against the back porch where, only yesterday, Patrick and Judd had shoveled.
Dad, I'm sorry.
Her lips moved. She wasn't sure if she'd spoken aloud. She had opened her heart to Jesus, and he had consoled her. Yes, it was Marianne Mulvaney's fault that it had happened. But it was not her fault that she could not give testimony, bear witness against the boy who was her assailant. Strange to be awake at this hour, and downstairs, alone. The big old farmhouse creaking in the wind. How many people had lived here, died here, since 1849? You thought such thoughts in solitude, before dawn, before the life of the household began. Now there was only the wind and the tick, tick, ticking of a dozen clocks to indicate that time is a joke, doesn't exist. Yet you need to believe. It was true she'd be returning to school next week. That was arranged. First, she would have to meet with Mr. Hendry, the principal of Mount Ephraim High, and Mrs. Langley, the guidance counselor. Marianne and her parents, that is. At least Mom, if Dad refused to come. There were so many rumors circulating, Mr. Hendry had told Mom, so many unverified, disturbing things being said about Marianne and Zachary Lunt, and a group of seniors involved in drinking, late-night partying, sexual misconduct. Mr. Hendry and Mrs. Langley hoped to discuss these matters before Marianne resumed classes, and Mom would be involved, of course. Marianne had the idea that her mother had already spoken with Mr. Hendry and Mrs. Langley on the phone at length. Possibly she'd even gone to see them. Marianne didn't ask and didn't know. Jesus, Jesus. He would guide her. He had been guiding her all along. How obsessed poor Michael had become with it. In the winter and spring of 1976, how heavily it weighed upon all their lives. What frightened Corinne was the change in Michael. Where once he'd been completely reliable, now he was unreliable. Oh, he might be telling the truth about where he'd been, working late. Then again, he might not. It was turning Corinne into the kind of wife who checks on her husband continuously. Discreet telephone calls to his office, questions innocently posed, pockets searched. How could this be happening to high-minded Corinne Mulvaney? Michael's moody silences, his nocturnal prowling, drinking, compulsive smoking, his mysterious telephone calls, his short temper with his sons, and his new habit of secrecy that alarmed her the most. What was he planning? My husband is not a violent man. He is not a murderer. Dear God, you know his heart. Help us. It was late April, after Easter. In bed upstairs, Corinne was holding Michael, feeling his heart beating through his body.
God help me. I don't know what else to do. If I can't protect my own daughter, my own children, my family. If I wasn't a coward, I would exact my own justice. I can't live with it. We'll have to sell the farm and move away. We're like lepers.
Corinne shut her eyes tight. She saw High Point Farm on the very edge of High Point Road, the steep drop along its most dangerous stretches, thinking,
"Why, we will fall over, fall to the bottom and be lost."
Michael was saying, pushing from her arms now, sitting up, rubbing his face, his swollen eyes, half sobbing, incredulous.
"It isn't just my daughter, it's all of us. She can't be blamed, but it's all of us.
I vowed I would love them all equally. I did, I tried. When they were babies, I tried, but the girl, she ran away with my heart. She can't be blamed, but that was how it was. Always I'd be thinking I would kill for her, my baby girl, but..."
Corinne said, sitting up beside him, "Michael, no, don't say such things. It's a sin to say such things.
I'm not strong enough, I'm a coward. How can I live knowing that? God help me, Corinne, I can't bear the sight of the girl any longer."
Michael began to sob helplessly, despairingly, in Corinne's arms. It seemed to her she could not hold him tight enough, enclosed enough. She would have wished to envelop him with her body as one might a small child, an infant, drawing him somehow inside her, stilling the terrible agitation of his thoughts. Oh, if she could swallow him up, save him.
"I wish to God I never had to lay eyes on her again," Michael whispered, in horror of what he was saying. "God forgive me, it's so."
Corinne heard herself whisper in reply, hesitating only a fraction of a second.
"I know, darling, I know."
She began to croon, rocking him. His hot, heavy, pulsing body, his maleness, his very bulk, that weight turned to despair, so heavy.
How had she been blind for so long, these weeks? How had she missed understanding? Here was her first love, her firstborn.
The others, the children born of her body, even Marianne, were hardly more than dreams, ripples on the surface of a dark, impenetrable water. From this man, from his body, their bodies had sprung. He was her first love.
"Darling, I know,"
Corinne crooned softly, as if it were a lullaby, seeing the goose comically entangled in nylon fishing line thrashing its wings, struggling in desperation.
"But I will save you, with God's help."
So Corinne and Michael Mulvaney clutched at each other desperately in the early hours of a day in April 1976, until at last, mutually exhausted, they lay back down together and slept. Slept. What a morning it must have been of swift, inspired arrangements. What bargaining, bartering, pleading, and coercing by telephone. For when Patrick and I returned home from school the following afternoon, we discovered that our sister Marianne was gone. Just gone. Mom had driven her, the Buick station wagon packed with as many of her things as it could hold, to Salamanca, New York, 100 miles south and west of High Point Farm, where she was to live from now on with a Hausman relative, a cousin of Mom's who, we were assured, was a very, very nice, very good-hearted Christian woman who'd never had children of her own. We must have stood there gaping, for Mom added quickly, as if this were a crucial point, that of course Muffin had gone with Marianne. "On her lap, all the way, purring," fixing us with a beaming neon smile. One by one, we went away. It's the story of American farms and small towns in the latter half of the 20th century. We went away. First of the Mulvaney children, even before Marianne went to live with a cousin of Mom's in Salamanca, was my older brother Mike, to live in Mount Ephraim initially and continue to work at Mulvaney Roofing, until the business encountered fiscal setbacks, Dad's term, and relations between father and son became strained, and more than strained, and Mike quit and joined the Marines. That would be in November 1977, approximately a year and a half after the events I've recorded, after it. And Marianne, of course, was gone. Living 100 miles away on the other side of the mountains with a cousin of Mom's none of us knew, in the town of Salamanca, none of us, except Mom, had ever seen. Weeks passed, and months, and though Mom had promised Patrick and me we'd drive down to visit Marianne soon, somehow we never got there, and Dad never spoke of going. In fact, he never spoke of Marianne in my hearing at all. This cousin of Mom's was named Ethel Hausman, and she was unmarried, a longtime receptionist and bookkeeper for a Salamanca podiatrist. Mom was vague about the woman, apologetic and enthusiastic at once. "Ethel isn't easy to know, but she's a deep, spiritual, good woman. I would trust with my life, I would." Since Marianne's vanishing, Mom had become yet more nervously extravagant in her speech, eyelids and fingers fluttering. Each Sunday at 8 p.m., Mom would telephone Ethel Hausman and speak with her for several minutes, and then with Marianne, in private. After 15 or 20 minutes, she would call Patrick and then me to speak with our sister. "Keep the conversation short, please," Mom would whisper. "This isn't a local call." So strange, talking with Marianne on the phone. How distant Marianne sounded now, her voice thin and flattened. "Because the mountains are in the way," I thought. Possibly Marianne had been crying while on the phone with Mom. Mom would resolutely not have been crying. Eyes bright, perfectly clear and dry. But she'd make an effort to be cheerful while speaking with me. I was reminded of certain of our hymns we'd sing, like marching songs chanted through clenched teeth. "Judd, how are you?" Marianne would ask eagerly, and the question confused me. It isn't one sisters and brothers ever ask of each other as kids. It's an adult question, one of the phony ones. Except I guess Marianne meant it. I'd mumble, embarrassed, "I'm okay, I guess," shrugging as if she could see me, and Marianne would cry, "Oh, Judd, gosh, I miss you. I can't wait to see you. Mom says..." I wouldn't know how to reply, just stood there gripping the receiver in misery, because Mom had warned Patrick and me not to discuss future plans with Marianne, never to speak of the future. It will just get her hopes up, and that would be cruel. Marianne would inquire after the animals, one by one, always beginning with Molly O. Oh, she missed Molly O. And how was Prince? How was Clover? How was Red? And how were the dogs, Foxy, Little Boots, Troy, Silky? And the cats, Big Tom, E.T., Snowball, Marmalade? And Feathers? She was always imagining she heard Feathers in the early morning when she was just waking up. And how were the goats, Blackie and Mamie, and the barn cats, and Captain Marvel, and all that crew? And the cows, and the sheep? Marianne always reported that she and Muffin were fine, but missing the family. It was so quiet and somehow so small there. We always assured Marianne that everyone was fine at High Point Farm, too. Last of all, Marianne would draw a deep breath and ask after Dad, as if she hadn't already asked Mom and Patrick. And I'd stand sweating, and the words I wanted to shout jammed in my throat, and Marianne's voice became plaintive, pleading. "Judd, there isn't anything wrong with Daddy, is there? He never seems to be home when Mom calls." I stammered, "I didn't know, I didn't think so. Dad was working hard these days." Marianne would begin to sound desperate, asking, "Does he ever say anything about me, Judd? Does he ever say my name?" And I would mumble, "Yeah, sure, I guess so." And she would ask, suddenly pleading, "When can I come home, Judd? Do you know?" But by this time, Mom, who'd been hovering close by, nervous as a cat, would take the receiver gently from me and say into the mouthpiece, in a playful Mom voice, "Sorry, this is your long-distance operator and your time has run out." Patrick left to enroll at Cornell in early September 1976 and would never live at High Point Farm again except for brief periods. That first Thanksgiving, when we were all looking forward to seeing him, he shocked us by not coming home. "Too much work," he explained tersely. Lab courses in biology, organic chemistry, physics. And at Christmas, he was home for only a few days of the long recess. Not only did he have too much work to do, he'd been hired as a biology lab assistant. The following summer, he was home only 2 weeks, returning to Ithaca to work in the lab. But Patrick had his own life now, and he certainly had his plans. His talk was all of amino acids, genetics, cellular biology. He had little to say about Cornell University itself. Meeting new people, making friends. His manner was stiff, polite, distracted. He endured Mom's effusive talk and as much as he could of her affection. His smile was the old pinch smile, a corner of his mouth tucked down in a look of virtual pain. But it seemed unconscious. It meant nothing. "Damn you, don't you care? Why don't you care?" I wanted to shout. Always I'd be waiting for Patrick to spend some time with me, just me, alone. His kid brother who missed him so. His kid brother at High Point Farm pining away like poor Silky, left behind and lonely. Once I came into his room where he was. Damn him. He hadn't been home 3 hours, studying a chart with the heading Mendelian Inheritance in Man, and I asked him if he'd spoken with Marianne or seen her. He sort of shrugged and looked embarrassed, meaning yes, he had, or no, he hadn't. Why does Dad hate Marianne so? Why doesn't he want to see her or even talk to her, I asked. And Patrick said, frowning, Dad doesn't hate her, it's just she reminds him of, you know. Lifting his arm in a way of Dad's that signaled, what the hell, what can you do? Spreading the fingers, letting the arm fall limp. I said, but that isn't Marianne's fault. Thinking I could hate Dad if Patrick gave me a sign. But Patrick said, soberly, looking at me for the first time since he'd come home, it isn't Dad's fault, either. God damn! Despite his best intentions, he was late! Marianne's bus was due at 5:05 p.m. in downtown Ithaca. Patrick had told her he'd be a few minutes late, unavoidably. But now he was very late, unable to get away from the university building until after 5:30 p.m., and it was another 8 minutes running to the lot where his Jeep was parked, and another 15 minutes getting downtown on traffic-clogged one-way streets. He could have wept, he was so angry. Angry at himself, mainly, for not being more assertive with Herring's assistant, who he guessed disliked him anyway as a 20-year-old undergraduate he couldn't quite intimidate. Don't make enemies, Patrick counseled himself uneasily. You will need all the help you can get. Since high school biology, Patrick's sophomore year, he'd known what he wanted to be, a research biologist. In late April 1978, Patrick was completing his second year of college at Cornell, and his grade point average was just 0.06 shy of perfect. He was proud of being alone in Ithaca, in an off-campus rooming house in the heterogeneous neighborhood known as College Town, yet never, or almost never, lonely. Proud of keeping the Mulvaneys at a distance, the obsessive thought of family. He loved them all, yet had no wish to see them frequently, nor even to speak with them often. He hadn't seen Marianne since the previous June, when he'd gone, the only Mulvaney, to her graduation at Salamanca High. He hadn't seen his parents and brother Judd for almost 8 months. When he'd discovered, to his disgust, that another time Marianne hadn't been invited home for Christmas, he decided not to go home himself, calling home to deliver a chilly little message saying he had too much lab work to do. Corinne said, on the verge of tears, "Oh, Patrick, how can you?" And Patrick said stiffly, "Well, Mom, how can you?" And Corinne said weakly, "If you mean about your sister, it's just that your dad isn't ready to see her yet. I'm doing a lot of concentrated praying about it, Patrick. I want you to know. And Marianne does know, and I told her I'm sure your dad will be ready. He'll be strong enough in a little while. Maybe Easter. Patrick?" Patrick said curtly, "Goodbye, Mom, and Merry Christmas," hanging up quickly before Corinne could say a word more. On the phone with Marianne for over an intense hour, Christmas Eve, Patrick meant to console her for the inexplicable cruelty with which their parents were treating her. But, as usual with Marianne, she'd ended up consoling him. "Patrick, don't worry about me, please. I'm happy. Of course I'm waiting for them to call me back, but I'm not, you know, only just that, waiting. I have plenty to do. I'm living my life, and I'm happy." Patrick ended up believing her, at least while they were on the phone together. Weird. Meeting Ethel Hausman, Corinne's cousin, with whom Marianne was living in Salamanca. Aunt Ethel, as she'd asked them with a forced smile to call her, was like a second, not very convincing mother in an amateur play whipped together by Corinne herself. Aunt Ethel turned out to be a big-boned, stoic, kindly woman of about 52 with a creased face whose habitual expression was a sad, wan hope, a look that carried with it the full, won't-be-surprised expectation of disappointment. Aunt Ethel smiled, too, and often, but it was a melancholy smile. Such an effort you almost could hear creaking. "Why is she so sad all the time?" Patrick asked, and Marianne put a finger to her lips to shush him. "Oh, but she isn't, Patrick, not this weekend." Not married, no child. Unlike her cousin Corinne, Aunt Ethel wasn't even a faithful churchgoer. Near as he could gather from his 3 days, 2 nights as a not very comfortable house guest of Aunt Ethel's, All she really provided for Marianne was a dreary little room at the rear of her dreary little house that smelled of rusted nails. In exchange, Marianne was an uncomplaining, bright, and tireless and reliable servant. Or maybe slave? Oh, Patrick, no. Marianne's eyes brimmed with tears when Patrick made this suggestion, pinch-style, rather mean and sly out of the corner of his mouth. Ethel Hausman had spoken vaguely of hoping to assist with Marianne's college expenses, but in the end, apparently, near as Patrick could gather, nothing came of it. Nor could the Mulvaneys help much. By summer 1977, Mulvaney Roofing was in what Corinne nervously called a temporary slough, and Michael Sr. was hoping to sell 5 or 10 acres of farmland if he can get a decent price. By fall 1977, Red, Prince, and Mollio had all been sold. Now, Marianne worked part-time, was a part-time student at Kilburn State College, in a small rural town near the Pennsylvania border, 200 miles south and west of Ithaca. Patrick had intended to drive down to see her, but always he'd been busy, distracted by work of his own. On the phone, he chided Marianne, "You deserve better than Kilburn State, for God's sake," as if it were Marianne's fault she'd ended up there and not, for instance, at glamorous Cornell. Marianne insisted she was happy at Kilburn. She'd made friends and liked all her professors and believed they liked her. And please remember that her high school grades hadn't been spectacular. At Kilburn, Marianne was enrolled in a history education program and lived in a co-op miles from campus to economize on expenses. When they spoke on the phone, Patrick could hear energetic voices in the background, a dog barking, a clatter of kitchen noise, radio music. Often he had to ask Marianne to speak louder, he couldn't hear. "It sounds like a railway station," he complained. What he meant was it sounded like a big, noisy, happy family. By the time Patrick drove to the bus station, parked his Jeep, and rushed into the Trailways waiting room, it was almost 6 p.m. He'd been thinking uneasily of Marianne all day, in fact for days since they'd made arrangements the week before. What would she think? That Patrick had forgotten her after all? He told her not to take a taxi, not to spend the money. He wanted to pick her up. He'd be there. Entering the waiting room, Patrick almost collided with passengers on their way out. An announcer's nasal voice intoned, "Albany, White Plains, New York City." Where was Marianne? He didn't see her. A girl turned, pretty, snub-nosed, not his sister. Another girl, a young woman carrying a baby. Where was Marianne? Hadn't she come to Ithaca after all? The thought that she might not have come, and he'd be alone that evening, filled Patrick with dismay. Or something had happened to her, in Kilburn, or on the bus, or here in Ithaca. He was the one who'd arrived almost an hour late. The interior of the Trailways bus depot in downtown Ithaca was a shabby, slipping-down sort of place, connected with a diner. There was a prevailing odor of cigarette smoke, griddle grease, wet wool. It had been a chill, rain-darkened April day, rife with puddles, and inadequately washed human bodies. There were benches here and a few stragglers sitting on them, but no Marianne. He realized how much he wanted to see her, now she wasn't in sight. He realized how much he was depending on this visit of hers, he who had so few friends. Well, no friends at all, exactly. Prowling the bus boarding area, circling the depot to check all the buses in sight, thinking just possibly he'd gotten the time wrong and Marianne was only now due, 6 p.m., but she wasn't here, wasn't anywhere. It was 6:20 p.m. Patrick circled the waiting room, asked a woman if she'd go into the woman's restroom to check if his sister was inside, but, of course, she was not. His lips moved silently. Marianne. Marianne. He should have sought out Zachary Lunt long ago and killed him. In his fantasy, a smart boy A-student fantasy, he'd force his sister's rapist to swallow poison, Lysol. Flaming agony, mouth, esophagus, stomach, liver. It would look like suicide, and not detectable. Weak, breathless, he leaned against the badly scratched wall of lockers, too shaky to continue pacing, yet not wanting to sit down amid the shabby, torn plastic seats and relinquish his advantage, which was the advantage of height. The man in the waiting room Patrick had assumed was a sailor obviously wasn't. He wore a navy blue, nautical-looking jacket and biker's boots, and his dark hair grew long and greasy onto his neck. He was about 30, unshaven, with quick, darting eyes and a damp mouth. As Patrick watched, the man rose stealthily, not straightening to his full height, carried the duffel bag with him, and went to sit 2 seats from an oblivious sleeping boy. But the boy wasn't a boy. Patrick saw, to his astonishment, that this was Marianne, his sister. Her hair cut cruelly short, face waxy pale and mouth slack, so without expression in the days of sleep he hadn't recognized her. She looked so young, so childlike. She wore a thin corduroy jacket, unbuttoned, and slacks with a stretch-band waist, and a flimsy white cotton T-shirt stamped in Green Isle Co-op. Her left breast, the size and apparent hardness of a green pear, was sharply outlined by the ribbed white fabric. On her feet, badly worn sneakers and no socks. On the seat beside her was a grimy canvas bag, also stamped Green Isle Co-op, stuffed with items. Patrick saw, to his disgust, the man in the nautical jacket staring at his sister, and in that instant saw her through the man's hungry eyes. A girl boy, sexually tantalizing because sexually ambiguous, vulnerable, unprotected, provocative.
Marianne!
Marianne's bluish, bruised eyelids flew open, as if she hadn't been fully asleep. Pinch style, Patrick scolded.
What the hell? I've been waiting around this dump for you for an hour. What are you doing asleep?
Cook Street, in heterogeneous college town, near an edge of the gigantic Cornell campus, was one of Ithaca's numerous steep-banked streets. Patrick estimated it at about 70 degrees. His two-room apartment at 114 Cook was at the top of a moldering stucco house long ago partitioned into apartments for students, mainly foreign graduate students. Patrick might have lived more conveniently in a residence hall on campus, within closer walking distance of his classes, but he valued privacy, relative isolation, and he couldn't tolerate his fellow undergraduates' juvenile behavior, noise at all hours, binge drinking, vomiting and brawling, ceaseless rock music. At Cornell, no one knew the name Mulvaney. 20,000 students. When Patrick had driven through campus, Corinne beside him in the station wagon loaded with his things, he'd been dazed and euphoric, contemplating size, distance, anonymity, while Corinne wrung her hands in her lap, fretting like any mom. But you'll be lost here. Oh, Patrick, you'll be lost here. No one will know who you are. At the rooming house on Cook Street, Patrick parked his Jeep at the curb, expertly turned the wheels inward, put on the emergency brake. Marianne, who had been exclaiming happily over the Cornell campus, Patrick had driven her through the main campus along elegant East Avenue and down the long hill to Central Avenue and back then to College Town, wanting her to see the enormous sloping hill behind the dignified old buildings, windswept, beautiful even at twilight in drizzle, stared up at the smudged stucco house that was so ugly, so melancholy and squat, and seemed to be at a loss for words. Patrick laughed.
Not quite the purple house, is it?
Marianne murmured. It was certainly a wonderful location, only a few blocks from campus. Inside, they climbed the stairs to the third floor. Patrick carried Marianne's bulky Green Isle bag over his shoulder. He was happy. Couldn't have been happier. What vast relief Marianne was there with him, and safe, and would be returning to Kilburn the following afternoon. To prepare for Marianne's visit, Patrick had hauled the residence vacuum cleaner up 2 flights of stairs and thoroughly vacuumed both his rooms. He dusted windowsills, lampshades, blinds. Whistling, he'd mopped the floors. He'd been in a good mood, mildly apprehensive, but not anxious.
Oh, Patrick, I can't wait. I miss you so. But are you sure you have time for me?
He'd removed from his bed the handmade rag quilt, red, white, and blue squares elaborately sewn together, of contrasting fabrics, cotton, denim, velvet, taffeta, corduroy, muslin, Corinne had given him from home, folded it and hid it away in the closet, because he couldn't be sure that their mother had given Marianne anything quite so nice to take with her to Salamanca. On Dryden Road, at a florist's, he'd bought a dozen fresh-cut flowers.